when we began last hour, we talked about how Ellen White, on a June day in 1904, was writing a letter from Nashville, Tennessee, in which she was very, very concerned about one aspect of Adventism. That's the safety of our young people and how they would fare in our educational system. Well, in 1904, just about a month before that, she gave one of the most remarkable testimonies that she's ever given to the Adventist Church. It was in the nature of a prediction. Somewhere in the future, something very strange, very challenging would happen within the church. And you and I need to understand what it was she said, because I think that you and I will be living with that prediction. Now, once again, we have to find this in its original form back in one of those little pamphlets that Ellen White wrote during that time of crisis, called Special Testimonies for the Church. It's Series B, number 2, page 54. And otherwise, if you can't find that, it will be in my book, Omega 2, on page 177. And here is how it reads. The enemy of souls has sought to bring in the supposition that a great reformation was to take place among Seventh-day Adventists. Well, let's stop there for a second. What's wrong with that? What is there about a reformation that should get us worried enough that we even spend time on an otherwise lovely Sabbath afternoon talking about it? You know, there are reformations and there are reformations. There are good ones and there are bad ones. This one evidently is a bad one, because she goes on to say in the very next phrase that this reformation would consist in giving up the doctrines which stand as the pillars of our faith. Now, something goes wrong within the church. Let's stop right there for just a second and let's go to Revelation 12:17. Revelation 12:17. We've talked about this before this weekend, but it just keeps seeming to fit. And here's one of those places where I think you'll find that it fits very, very clearly. What does Revelation 12:17 say? Somebody tell me. And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war on the remnant of her seed, who what? Keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus. Let me stop there just a second. Now, you folk understand that I'm not a preacher. I've demonstrated that already, I'm sure. I'm not trained for it, and I really admire those who are. I've often said, the Lord has given our ministers a special gift, and we need to be very grateful that they have it. One of the things I know I don't have is the patience it takes to be a good pastor. Now, if I tried to run a church board meeting, I'm afraid they'd be calling 911 before the night's over. So I'm not a pastor. I'm a lay person like you folk, and I'm coming to these studies just from my perspective and in the experiences the Lord has given me. Now, among my experiences, well, I spent some time on active duty as a naval officer, and I had to deal with some insights there that helped me a little better understand what's going on in the world today, I think. Well, this text, Revelation 12:17, I react to now in my naval officer's capacity. By the way, I still have my commission. I still have on my the lower left-hand side of my car windshield, Miramar Naval Air Station. I got a sticker. I'm still not disconnected totally from the military. So I see Revelation 12:17 as a military issue, and I identify in that text two clear military targets. Now, when you fight a war, you have two kinds of targets. You have a tactical target and you have a strategic target. Let's talk about the first one, the tactical target. What is a tactical military target? It is what you hit and destroy, hoping to reduce the enemy's capacity to make war. Now, you all remember Desert Storm, don't you? Right after midnight, January 15, we got busy prosecuting that war, and what was the very first thing we hit around Baghdad? Remember that? Took out their radar installations and their communication network. Why did we do that? We're trying to stick our fingers in Saddam Hussein's eyes. We're trying to blind him. Take his radar out. He can't see us coming. We've degraded his warfighting capability. That is a tactical target. Now, in a spiritual sense, what would be the tactical target embedded there in Revelation 12:17? Huh? The dragon was wroth with a woman. He went to make war with the law and with the testimony of Jesus, which is what? The spirit of prophecy. I knew I shouldn't have gone down from up there because I've got something you folk need to see. Let me get it for you. Because I think this is probably as good a time as any to raise this point. So I'm going to get it out of my briefcase and then I'll come back down there and share it with you. The spirit of prophecy is the tactical target in this war. Why? The devil is trying to do to us what we did to Saddam. He's trying to stick his fingers in our eyes, blind us, so we can't see the enemy coming. The spirit of prophecy gives us a clear view of the tactics the enemy will use. And the best illustration is what I'm reading to you right now. It's as though she has opened the windows, she has shown us the future, and we see the direction from which the attacks will come. All right, so the spirit of prophecy is a tactical target. The devil's trying to degrade our war-fighting capability. Now, I recognize for just a couple minutes here, I'm going to be kind of turning right on Main Street here. We're going to explore a couple blocks. Don't worry, we'll do a U-turn. We'll get back to where we were going. Is that okay? All right, let's talk about the spirit of prophecy. You folk cannot help but be aware that there are out in, where else, California, some voices that are critical of Ellen White. Are you aware of that? Such that they have said, well, you have to be a little careful with this woman because, you see, she copied a lot of stuff and therefore she is what lawyers would call a plagiarist. You ever heard those arguments? Well, one of those arguments was raised by an individual by the name of Walter T. Ray, who once was a working pastor. He's now retired, and he is now has written a book and is convinced by his research that Ellen White was a plagiarist. Well, now, what I'm going to do right now, I'm going to do for the simple reason that I want you people to really clearly understand that Ellen White isn't wrong just because somebody says she is. Now, you folk have probably during the course of the last few months, once in a while at least, watched segments of the O.J. Simpson trial, haven't you? Okay? As you've watched that, have you noticed that one of the things that a lawyer will do will be to try to find a prior inconsistent statement when somebody's on the stand? So Dr. Cotton is up there talking all about DNA, and he says, yeah, Dr. Cotton, but do you remember a while back you said this, and it doesn't sound like what you're saying now? Well, that's a lawyer's way of trying to show that the witness hasn't been consistent. Well, folk, in my hand, I have Exhibit A. It is a compendium on Daniel and Revelation, in which Ellen White's writings on those two books are collected in a syllabus form. Would you like to guess whose name appears on the cover? Walter T. Ray. Now, can you guess what I would do as counsel for the defense if Ellen White were on trial for plagiarism and this fine gentleman were on the witness stand for the prosecution? Now it's my turn, Adam. I'm going to do some cross-examination. And it goes like this. Good afternoon, Mr. Ray. Are you comfortable and can you hear me well? Yes. Your Honor, may I approach the witness? I'm given permission and I walk up to him and I say, sir, I have in my hand a syllabus on the writings of Daniel and Revelation compiled by somebody. Will you please, sir, read into the record of this court clearly so the jury can hear you, whose name appears on the cover? Walter T. Ray. Fine, thank you. I'm going to open the book. And I'm going to ask you, sir, to read from page 3 of your book, the first paragraph. And here is what he reads into the record. Many authors have done acceptable work on the books of Daniel and Revelation. None, however, have had the divine insight of Mrs. E. G. White. It is for this reason this material was put in syllabus form, that our people might read the statements as they came from God, unhampered by man's opinion. And I would say, thank you, sir. Now, I just have one more request. Turn the page. Page 4. Will you read to me from paragraphs 2 and 3 of what you yourself compiled a few years ago? And here is what he would have to read. Satan is constantly pressing in the spurious to lead away from the truth. The very last deception of Satan will be to make of none effect the testimony of the Spirit of God. There will be a hatred kindled against the testimonies, which is satanic. At which point, I would retrieve Exhibit A, offer it in evidence, ask that it be marked, and say, thank you, Your Honor, no further questions, the defense rests. Now, do you see the point that Ellen White isn't wrong just because somebody says she is? There is a ready answer to the legal charge of plagiarism. That isn't my job this afternoon. I don't have time to get into it. Take my word for it, as a lawyer, the issue of plagiarism can be handily dealt with. Well, in any event, Revelation 12:17 says, there comes a time when the spirit of prophecy comes under attack. That's the tactical target. Now, remember, there are two kinds of targets in a war. One's tactical, one is strategic. What's the strategic target? That is the recapture of Kuwait so that we can restore their rightful government. That is the recapture of Europe so we can put out of business obscenities like Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz. In other words, it is the winning of the war. The strategic target is what the war is being fought for. Now then, what is the strategic target in this war called the Great Controversy? It's the law. Are we clear on that? The law is the issue of this war. Ellen White says that Satan's claim right after the fall of the angels in heaven was the law can't be kept. That's the issue that has to get dealt with. So anytime anybody comes to you with a theology that in any way confuses that issue, they have to be in some degree wrong, because that's the issue we're fighting for. Everything else spins off from that. Notice something else about Revelation 12:17. The dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with whom? What was it again? The what? The remnant. That's what you folks said. Now, ladies, I need some help from you. Those of you who sow, what is a remnant? All right, I hear you saying it. It's what's left over when you cut everything off, you know, and you've used up the rest. It's what you got left. You notice that in Revelation 12:17, the dragon is not making war with the woman per se. He's making war on just what's left. Do you follow the distinction? That suggests to me something's happened inside the church. There has been a shaking, and they're not all still there. He's only able to make war on who is left after the shaking. Something's gone wrong inside. Now, thank the Lord for the spirit of prophecy. That's why I took this time to talk about the issue. Because Revelation 12:17 shows us there's going to be trouble from inside, but we don't get the details of it, and we need the details if we're going to be ready. That makes sense? Okay, now here are the details. Ellen White is speaking, Series B, number 2, page 54. She says there's this reformation going to come along, and it will consist in giving up the doctrines which stand as the pillars of our faith. Now she goes on speaking. The principles of truth that God in His wisdom has given to the remnant church would be discarded. Our religion would be changed. Our religion would be changed. Keep that phrase in your mind for the next 20 minutes. Then she says, the Sabbath would be lightly regarded, and nothing would be allowed to stand in the way of this new movement. Evidently, it has energy, it has power, it's well organized, and it steamrollers over the opposition. Well, what Ellen White describes there is really quite astounding. Think it through. She's talking about abandonment of pillar doctrines. discarding of established truth, a change in our religion, replacement of historic Adventism with intellectual philosophy, a quiet abandonment of the Sabbath. And then she says nothing about this is left to chance. Books of a new order are scattered across the church. Now that, to me, is a pretty clear way to describe a media campaign to fight for the minds and hearts of our people and convince them that it's time for something new and different. And evidently this is all done with determined force, because nothing, she says, is allowed to stand in the way of the new movement. Now, folk, when you see that collection of things all hooked up together, believe me, it is not an accident. That kind of stuff is planned. That's the only way it happens. Well, by strange coincidence, everything that I have just read to you from Ellen White is reminiscent of something that I saw in the book that I was describing at the close of our last hour. A Jesuit plan to erase the Reformation and reunite all of Christianity under the protection of the Pope. Well, as I told you as we closed last hour, one day I was browsing through the graduate research stacks at our library, looking for something else, and lo and behold, this little purple book popped out into my field of view. I just really grabbed my attention. On the spine, it says Unity of the Churches, and the names are Fries and Rahner. Now, Karl Rahner is one of the best-known Jesuit theologians of the 20th century. A German theologian. And the title is Unity of the Churches, an Actual Possibility. So now this cover is telling me there's a couple of Jesuits out there think the whole Christian faith can be reunited. Do you suppose at this point I'm just a little interested? Yeah, I'm getting curious by now. So I open up the book. And inside this book I discover eight very systematic, very logical theses. They move like steps, one to the next, leading you to a destination. And they tell a plan to reunite the Christian faith. Let me digest those for you as briefly as I can, so they make some sense to you. Point number one. Karl Rahner recognized that the idea of reunifying the Christian faith would be unpopular, at least for some Protestants. You know, we still, some of us, remember the causes of the Reformation. And so rather than to risk this plan by exposing it to a lot of people who might have a strong reaction against it, what he suggested was take it to only a very few. In the targeted churches that you want to absorb back with Rome, you don't take it to the membership because they might just kick their heels up. Instead, you take it to a few thought leaders, a few theologians. He said, and I'm quoting, on the basis of their theological expertise, those church leaders could decide in favor of church unity. Notice, just a few leaders get the idea. Well, now the plan moves into high gear. These leaders, once they get sold on the idea of reunifying with Rome, are expected to work politically within their own denominations. Now, that makes sense. That's good planning. Because who can speak the language and concepts of a church better than somebody who's an insider? They know what you want to hear. They know what you're comfortable with. They know how to express it in the jargon that is reassuring. So they work politically within their own churches. Now, gently at first, but persistently, they keep the idea before the membership in meetings, in publications, in subtle changes of terminology and emphasis. Little by little, as you read and listen to these people, you are unmistakably pulled in a direction. Your church is changing directions. But it's done gently and subtly, so the masses won't initially recognize what's happened. In other words, what they're doing is reprogramming. Now, in today's manipulative world, the technical term for that is a paradigm shift. Have you ever heard that term? Paradigm shift. What that means is you get reprogrammed so that you reach different conclusions from the ones you used to. Well, all of this has a little bit of political intrigue, and it's kind of a fascinating plan to read. Rahner says they will work with zeal among their church members, making sure of the support of their members before bringing the matter to a vote. So there is political activity that's going on here. Now, point number two. Karl Rahner believed that the change could be accomplished because he's convinced that most Protestants are, to use his term, liberal. That's his word, that's not mine. He says they're so liberal that if you use a few familiar words like salvation and the cross and love and unity and things like that, most Protestants aren't going to know or care about anything else. They'll say, that's good enough for me, that sounds like the gospel, that's acceptable. Furthermore, he said that most Protestants were so passive that they would readily follow their leadership if leadership said this is the thing to do. Now, to put it in his words, he said the average congregation in the Protestant churches practices the kind of obedience to their church leaders that is customary in the Roman Catholic Church. Therefore, one should not overestimate the danger of a rebellion. Now, let me stop here and tell you that I fully recognize I'm given some rather theoretical stuff to you at an awful time of day. What is it? It's like 4:45. You folk have had a good potluck, and thank you, ladies. You have done yourselves real proud with that good food down there. And we have just about had time to let that food hit bottom and have its ultimate effect. Now, you recognize, of course, this is the time of day when lawyers don't like to have to be, trying the case. Marcia Clark would love to get done with cross-examination before this time of day. Turn it over to the dream team, Judge. Let's see if they can keep them awake, okay? Now, I know this is a bad time of day to do this, but it happens to be the time we're doing it. I'm going to do my dead-level best to say this in a way that will be, of some value to you. But I want you to know, I understand, it's kind of a tired time of day. Believe it or not, I can feel it too. Okay. So, Rahner says, these passive people, if the leaders do their political work well, probably won't object. He says, therefore, they can be expected to follow their leaders into union with Rome. Now, that leads him to point number three. As the idea of unification begins to grow, as it builds some momentum among these churches, you form an ecumenical union of the churches. Now, that alone would spook a lot of Protestants. I understand that, a lot of Protestants aren't ready for that yet. So he's got a way around that objection. He says, we're not going to get rid of your individual denominations. You Methodists can have your synod. You Baptists can have your convention. You Adventists can have your general conference. God bless you. Keep your churches. You can have them. Nothing's changed. You've all got all the denominations you used to have. Oh, by the way, there's one little proviso that we do need so the thing will work. Let me read it to you from Thesis 8a, or 4a of the book. Quote, all partner churches acknowledge the meaning and right of the Petrine service of the Roman Pope to be the concrete guarantor of the unity of the church. Now that is theological legalese for something I can say a whole lot simpler. What does it mean? Everybody acknowledges that the Pope is the supreme guarantor of Christian unity. We all come under his umbrella. So even though the individual churches seem to remain, what has happened? We have effectively reunited. And it gets even more interesting still as we move on. So now we begin to have a reunification under the umbrella of the Pope. Now, at this point, the Christian church will be poised for an acceleration of the process. To accelerate the ecumenical process, the next thing they'll do is have lots of exchange and interchange between the various churches. For example, there will be lots of pulpit exchanges. On Sunday, the Presbyterian is over at the Methodist church, the Methodist is over at St. Mary's Parish, and yesterday, if this plan works the way they want it to, the parish priest of St. Mary's was preaching to the Adventists. Okay? Exchange of pulpits. Now, why do you suppose two very bright, far-thinking Jesuits would say that's something that has to be done in order to effect reunification? Well, I'll tell you why. Until you see these other people as flesh and blood people, they're still at a distance from you. They are nothing but a group of Methodists, or they're Catholics, or Presbyterians. But you get one of their pastors up here on a Sabbath or Sunday morning, whenever your denomination speaks. He's going to bring his very best sermon with him, don't you think? Going to do his best performance. Afterward, in the social hall, he becomes a real flesh and blood human being with a wonderful sense of humor who's having coffee with you and talking the points of common Christian interest. Now, it's a rule of human interchange that if you endure very much of this, what's going to happen to your thinking? Pretty soon you're going to say, wait a second, these people are real human beings. They love the Lord. What is the point of us being divided by doctrine anymore? Do you understand me? Now that, my friends, might just be the bait that could catch some Adventists. Because you see, what we would be tempted to say would be, how important is doctrine anyway? Why don't we just all unite on the idea that we love Jesus? Now, there's something very beautiful about that thought. There really is. Love is the very center of the gospel. I hope, fellow Adventists, that we never, ever lose sight of love. If we start talking the law and we don't have the love of Jesus in our hearts, I mean self-sacrificing love that gets joy out of somebody else's happiness and makes that our happiness. If we talk the law in the absence of that, we got nothing. So love is the very center of the gospel. Don't ever forget it. So that when things like this are said, if you don't have a very clear discrimination of what real love is, you can easily get fooled. Now see, the problem here is that love is a very, very fragile word. Like things that are very beautiful, it's also very fragile, isn't it? And early in my practice, when I did a lot of divorce work, I, on more occasions than I like to think about, would see a marriage go through the divorce court and little children go through the meat grinder of that experience simply because a father or mother had discovered a new, quote, love. You follow me? So love, you see, is a very fragile thing. It's a word that can be bent until it really doesn't mean what it used to mean. And so in a theological setting, while love is important, we have to be sure we're using the term right. Now, what's the connection between love and doctrine? You folk help me. I've jabbered at you here long enough. You folk tell me, what is the connection between love and doctrine? Jesus Christ. Okay, any other ideas here, please? All right, it motivates us. It's the motivating factor. You know, Ellen White says that love is the agency God uses to wash sin out of the life. Kind of a neat idea, isn't it? Any other ideas on how love and doctrine are connected? Because we better get this thought through. Yes, please. Seguro que sí. Absolutely right. Sanctify them through what? Thy truth, thy word is truth. Now, does this make sense to you?
Doctrine is the character of Jesus.
All right. All right. Doctrine is the character of Jesus. You're really coming almost identically to the bullseye I'm looking for, and that is this. Doctrine is the way you act out love, isn't it? Isn't it? See, the Ten Commandments are ways you express love, right? The first four of them are how you express love to God. And one of those, the fourth commandment, will at the end of time prove whether you really love Jesus more than the ability to buy and sell. Okay? The other six prove whether you really love your neighbor. Hey, some of them even prove whether you love yourself. You know that? People say all these doctrines of Advent, the health message, for example. Folks, since when was love to yourself shown by hardened arteries and Sunday morning hangovers? See, all these doctrinal things are ways we express love. And the fourth commandment is an end time issue, and the Ten Commandments just happen to be a little doctrinal, don't they? So that when we say, let's forget all of these doctrines and just reunite on the idea that we love Jesus, how can you do it? How can you express love to Jesus in the absence of the doctrinal Ten Commandments? See? So there's a situation we find. Now, the plan, however, to reunite the Christian faith that's formulated by these two Jesuits like a Swiss watch, brilliantly put together, carries a concealed algorithm in it that presents itself as a question. Why let doctrinal issues separate us from other Christians? That one could catch some Adventists. Could sure catch some California Adventists. Easy. Well, all of this leads to another step in Rahner's proposal, and that is to abolish doctrine as a source of controversy. He says we're not going to have any more squabbles over doctrine for the simple reason that every church that joins this ecumenical union will be required as a condition of joining it to refuse to reject any doctrine of any other sister church. You cannot reject anybody else's doctrine. Now, if the Catholics are in it, and I just suspect they would be, what if we join that thing? All of a sudden, we have things we can't reject anymore, like the Assumption of the Blessed Mother, like the real presence in the Mass, in the host, like papal infallibility. Come on, folk, there are some problems there. But all of this stuff lines up absolutely with what I was looking for when I found the book. When I was looking for the documents of Vatican II, I was looking for the post-conciliar documents. This is what I found on my way there. But the post-conciliar documents on page 515 say that this is the goal of Vatican II. And I'm quoting, "When the obstacles hindering ecclesiastical communion have been surmounted, the unity of all Christians may at last be restored, celebrating one Eucharistic mystery." Now, I recognize that that is kind of tortured language, but let's go through it one more time, because this is one you better know. One of the goals of Vatican II says that the obstacles hindering our reunification will be surmounted. And when it happens, the unity of all Christians may be restored. And then it says we will all be celebrating one Eucharistic mystery. Now, any ex-Catholics here? What's the Eucharist? That's the host. So that when the parish priest elevates the host and in the good old days said in hocus corpus meum, or now says, "This is my body," what's he doing? He is offering Jesus one more time. That's the Eucharist. That is the heart and soul of Catholicism. You cannot get rid of the Eucharist. If you do, you have nothing left of the Catholic faith. The very heart and soul of Catholic worship. When the host is on the altar, there are people who go into Catholic churches and say, "I can feel the real presence there. Incarnate God is there in that sanctuary." Very important to Catholics. Now, that is the reason why, from a Protestant perspective, the Roman Catholic Mass presents us with such a problem. That's the reason. Because a human priest is seeming now to control the Son of God, raising the host and offering him again. Now, what's wrong with offering Jesus in sacrifice again? What's wrong with that? Okay, he's our high priest now, and how many times was he offered for the sins of many? Once. That is so important that dear old Moses lost translation over that issue. He hit the rock a second time, symbolically striking the Lord one more time, and God said, "Moses, I love you like no one else on earth, but I can't translate you now. You have broken something very, very precious, very significant." See? So the idea that Jesus dies once for all is very important. That truth is lost sight of in the Roman Catholic Mass. That's why, if we ever accept into Protestantism the concept of the Roman Catholic Eucharist, we have planted within our own numbers the seeds for our own destruction as Protestants. Well, the goal of Vatican II is reunite the Christian faith, and everybody will celebrate a single type of communion. It has to be the Mass. Now, let me ask you a question. Just suppose that this plan got fairly well advanced in the Christian world, and people began to buy into it, including buy into the idea of celebrating some kind of common communion. How would you sense, as a Protestant, that something like this is going on inside your Protestant church? How could you sense that the plan is underway, it's being promoted? I'll give you one idea. That would be if Roman Catholic terminology and communion techniques mysteriously suddenly start showing up in your communion service. If that ever happens, at least think about it, because it is part of the plan. If Roman Catholic communion terms or techniques show up in a Protestant service, at least you have to ask, why is it happening? So there the plan is in a nutshell. Convert the leaders of Protestantism. Expect to find a liberal and submissive laity. Form an ecumenical union in which pastors exchange pulpits. Be accepting of every other church's doctrine and acknowledge the Pope as the guarantor of unity. That's the plan. Now, compare that plan that I've just kind of summarized for you with Testimonies to Ministers, page 474. Ellen White, once again, is in holy vision privileged to overhear the words of Lucifer as with his high command he's planning how to destroy Adventism. And here is what he says. We must exert all our wisdom and subtlety to deceive and ensnare those who honor the true Sabbath. Through those who have a form of godliness but know not the power, we can gain many. Those of this class who are apt and intelligent will serve as decoys. Let me stop a second. What was Father Rahner's plan? Go for the thought leaders, the brightest and the best. What does Ellen White say Lucifer is planning? Go for those who are bright and intelligent. They'll serve as decoys. Now notice the group, the very best. Why choose these people? Because they're already inside the church. Ellen White says, in the words of Lucifer, many will not fear their influence because why? Because they profess the same faith. Now, what will the result be? What is Lucifer planning this to lead to? He says, quote, we will thus lead them to conclude that the requirements of Christ are less strict than they once believed, and that by conformity to the world they would exert a greater influence with worldlings. Thus, they will separate from Christ, and ere long they will be ready to ridicule their former zeal and devotion. End of quote. Testimonies to Ministers, 474. Any of you know any third-generation Adventists from missionary families who now ridicule their former zeal and devotion? I wish I did not, but very sadly I do. Now, that's the plan to destroy Adventism. We've heard it from a human perspective, and it is working very well. This plan is not something we may see in the future. It's deep into its fulfillment. It's already at work in a lot of Protestant churches, and it probably explains some of the pressures we feel in Adventism. That's the plan. Now, the question I guess all of us are going to ask next is, will the thing work? It's designed to destroy the Reformation. Will it work? And the dreadful answer is that it will come close. Mrs. White bluntly warns, and I quote, the church may appear as about to fall. Now, thank the Lord she adds a promise. What's the promise? It does not fall. It remains while the sinners in Zion will be sifted out. This is a terrible ordeal, but it must take place, she says. Now, that I really want to emphasize. I mean, if you forget most nearly everything else I've said this weekend, please don't forget that I am convicted the Lord will use this organized church to finish His work. Thoroughly convinced of that. Why? Because it's His church. There's a very practical reason, too. Folk, we're too late to the end of time to get anything new up. There just ain't time for it. So the Lord's going to use this church. Now, remember also, what she says is who gets sifted out during the shaking process? It's not the righteous people who leave. The sinners in Zion are sifted out, and those who remain are loyal to the truth. Now, I have no illusions. I think we may face some real challenges or maybe some real trauma. We may see institutions lost. We may lose in the future economic turmoil in this country whole systems of institutions. It could happen. This church could face an economic challenge like you wouldn't believe. It could happen that way, too. But the Lord promises He's going to work through this church and hold it together. And that's what gives me hope. A lot of times some people get all full of zeal and they say, oh, the church is full of apostasy. And it's time to get out, get into something purer and better. Well, I got to tell you that little story that I oftentimes bore people with about my airplane. I was in Southern California. I was leaving Riverside Airport. I needed to fly back up into the Central Valley. And there were some forecasts of winds. Now, in the fall of the year, we get these Santana winds coming in off the desert, and they come in at high speed. They're just whistling. And when they come bouncing down over the mountains in the L.A. Basin, they form turbulence you don't want to be flying in, believe me. But flight service said, no, it's still they're still reporting clear up over Elmo intersection, over Hollywood, Burbank, and over the mountains. We think get you through okay. So I filed a flight plan. I took off, and I hadn't been in the airborne about 10 minutes until I realized that was my mistake of the week. The plane was starting to really get shaken around like a rag doll. Well, I call flight service. I said, have you got any reports now of turbulence? They said, yeah, severe to extreme on your route of flight. At which point, I say, oh, help. You know, it's time to do a 180. And so the Lord helping me, as I asked, I called the airport. I said, I am coming back. They say, any runway, any direction. And I start my descent. By this time, the winds are really looking for me. The airplane is moving up 500 to 1,000 feet a minute, and abruptly the bottom drops out of your gizzard because you hit a downdraft, you hit wind shear down, you go at the same rate of speed. So I'm lowering the landing gear, I'm flattening propeller discs, I'm doing whatever I can do to get the airplane slowed down, manageable, and still right side up. We do everything on our approach, including pray. Yeah, there's one thing I didn't do on final approach to the airport. You know what it was? I didn't open the door and get out. Because the airplane was still the only place in the sky for me, see? Now, with the church, we sometimes face the same problem. We're going to have a rough ride once in a while. Stay with the church. But at the same time, I think in some of these future challenges, you and I can be useful to the church. And that's what I want to close with now. What do you do when the storm breaks? What do you do when something like this comes looking for the remnant church and maybe find some takers on the inside? Because don't rule out the possibility. It could explain a lot. I'm much less concerned about Jesuit people being inside our church than I am Jesuit ideas. The idea is what worries me, because some of these Jesuit ideas are so very well expressed that unless you're a very careful student of the Word, you can become a host for a virus, and you can carry it, and you don't even know what you're doing. Believe me, some of this stuff is very profound. So, I don't think we should go on witch hunts in our church looking for people. Let's look for truth, and when something doesn't line up with truth, let's deal with the issue rather than taking it onto ourselves to attack people. Well, what do you do when the storm breaks? Number one, I think we could get some good advice from Ellen White, who back in the Kellogg apostasy, when the church was also severely challenged, put it this way. The enemy agents are working unceasingly to prevail against the truth. Where are the faithful guardians of the Lord's flocks? Where are His watchmen? Are they standing on the high tower giving the danger signal, or are they allowing the peril to pass unheeded? My message to you is this: no longer consent to listen without protest to the perversion of truth. There comes a point in which you have to be heard. Don't consent to listen to error without protest. Okay, that's lesson number one. Now let's get practical. How are you going to do that? How do you defend the truth in the right way? I got four little rules here that make sense to me, and I'll share them with you. Maybe they'll be of some help to you folk. Number one, I've already mentioned, the most basic rule of all, stay inside the church. Enfeebled and defective, needing constantly to be warned and counseled, the church is nevertheless the object of Christ's supreme regard. Stay inside. Point number two. We should never ever defend truth in a way that would bring embarrassment to Jesus. Now you remember old Simon Peter? You know, he had his sword on. He had promised the Lord, they may all the rest of them run, but I'll be there with you. Don't worry about it, Jesus. You and we can handle them. So when the challenge came, what'd Peter do? He pulls that old fisherman's sword out that he's used to cut kelp and dress fish and stuff, and he goes after this guy. Now, I got news for you. I don't think Simon Peter was looking for that guy's ear. I think he's looking for the middle of his head. He's so full of adrenaline, he can't hold a sword steady. He misses and he takes the ear off. Folk, you and I can do that too, can't we? We can go out there to defend the Lord and defend His truth, and all we do is cut off people's ears. Real important to remember, you only defend truth in the way that Jesus would have done it Himself. Now, Ellen White in Gospel Workers puts it this way. Of all the people in the world, reformers should be the most selfish, the most kind, and the most courteous. Point number three. Yeah, the most kind, the most unselfish, and the most courteous. What did I say? Well, I'm sorry. It's getting late in the day, and I'm needing help. Don't hesitate, folk. Just let me know when I say it wrong. Okay. The most unselfish, the most kind, the most courteous. Well, let's read on here. This comes from Gospel Workers 507. She makes the point here that the worker who manifests a lack of courtesy, who speaks hastily or acts thoughtlessly, may close the door to hearts so that he can never reach them. Now, what you're trying to do is you're trying to reach people, right? Okay, why get the door slammed by being, let me get this right, selfish? Did I get it right that time? Okay. Point number three. We should place our concerns before responsible church leadership in a kind and Christ-like way. I mean, these brethren don't read minds. If you don't speak, they're not going to know what your concerns are they? So write your church leadership in a kind and Christ-like way. Let them know what your concerns are. If you fail to speak, if the majority doesn't speak, what's going to happen? A small minority can make it look to church leadership like they're the voice of the church. Don't let it go by default. So speak out. Oh, by the way, it might be kind of nice, before you have something to complain about or some concern to raise, if you've got good church leadership, once in a while, write them a letter and say, hey, elder, I'm not writing to complain about anything or ask for anything. I just want to tell you that we're praying for you. And we appreciate your leadership. They deserve that, too. You know, being a church leader is not an easy job these days, and they deserve our encouragement. Okay. Point number four. Finally, there may be times when we feel despair, when it seems like the brethren aren't listening. When you get those form letters, you know, from the deputy assistant, somebody other, letting you know the head guy never saw your letter. Elder so-and-so is pleased to tell you that he appreciates your thought. May the Lord bless you sincerely. Okay? Am I the only one that gets letters like that? Okay? Once in a while, it may seem as though you're not getting heard, and there's a moral issue, and you really care about the welfare of the church. What do you do then, when it seems like things are going wrong in spite of your concern? You know something? At that moment, you got the mightiest weapon of all. You know what it's called? It's called intercessory prayer. Get on your knees and pray for your church. It's what Daniel did when his church was failing to respond at the time of Daniel 9 to the need to go back and rebuild the temple. They don't want to go back. Who wants to go back there? We're making money in Babylon. You know what? That's why I like my Jewish friends. You put them in any kind of a miserable fix like that, even like captivity in Babylon, pretty soon they've bubbled right to the surface and they're making money. They're very, very talented people, aren't they? Well, that happened in Babylon. And Daniel looks at his church. He says, history's ready. The prophecy has run its course. We ought to be going home. But the church wasn't ready. And Daniel didn't get a mimeograph or a printing press, you know, and start publishing the sins of his church. He got on his knees. And what was it he said? Lord, we have sinned. Now, Daniel doesn't have any sins listed in the Bible that he did. He was a sinner, no doubt, but nothing important enough for the Bible to recall. But Daniel nevertheless lumps himself with his failing church. So, intercessory prayer. I am convinced, brothers and sisters, that if even a significant number of God's people would engage in intercessory prayer for the leadership of the church and for the second coming to occur, you and I have the power to accelerate events and bring the second coming on sooner with nothing more than intercessory prayer. So there is a plan in place. I think it is a very brilliant plan. I think it's deeply involved. I think it's very mature. I think it explains the headlines you are seeing. And I think it will challenge Adventism and folk. They that are with us are more than they that be against us.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.